If you think like, act like, or are trying to grow like a franchise, then the Franchise Euphoria podcast is for you. Hello and welcome, everybody. Josh Brown here, and I created this podcast for one main goal: to help people who are trying to grow their business through franchising or franchise-like structures. I've been practicing law now as a franchise lawyer for many, many years, and I've seen it done the right way and the wrong way. This podcast is not filled with a bunch of legal mumbo jumbo. Rather, I talk with real people, people who have been there, have done it, are doing it right now. And I also dive deep into specific topics related to franchising. So if this is of interest to you, you are at the right place. Well, I am so excited for today's interview with Scott Greenberg. Scott helps franchisees improve their leadership skills and grow their business. For more than two decades, he's been a full-time speaker and franchise performance coach, giving presentations throughout the world to franchise clients that include McDonald's, Great Clips, Anytime Fitness, Wyndham Hotel Group, Remax, and countless other emerging, mid-sized, and large franchise organizations. Scott specializes in the human elements of franchise operations that include franchisee mindset and brand culture, employee management and coaching, and customer experience and retention. For 10 years, Scott was a multi-unit franchisee with Edible Arrangements. In addition to building a top-ranked flagship location in Los Angeles, Scott acquired a second struggling location and made it profitable within the first year. His operation won the Edible Arrangements Best Customer Service and Manager of the Year awards out of more than 1,000 locations worldwide. Scott sold his enterprise in 2015 and today focuses full-time on speaking, coaching, and writing for the franchise industry. He is the VIP contributing writer for Entrepreneur.com and Global Franchise Magazine, and the author of the new book, new-ish book, it's been out a little bit, The Wealthy Franchisee, Game-Changing Steps to Becoming a Thriving Franchise Superstar. I got to tell you, I read this book, and I think it's absolutely fantastic. I think it could be. It's certainly in the top one or two of the best franchise books that I've read. And what you'll hear today in my interview with Scott is his authenticity, transparency, and knowledge just of the franchise business, but most importantly, the human elements of the franchise business, which so often go understated or go overlooked. You know, people just look at the franchise world as a transactional world. And yes, it certainly is, but there's a big human component to it. I really love this interview with Scott, and I think you will as well. So without further ado, please enjoy this interview with Scott Greenberg. Hello, Scott. Welcome to Franchise Euphoria. How you doing?
I'm good. Glad to be here.
Well, I'm thrilled to have you. You know, I've been doing this podcast now for 8+ years, interviewed a lot of different people, franchisors, franchisees, and there's a lot of books out there on franchising. And truth be told, I heard about your book when it first came out a little while back, and I didn't read it at first, not for any particular reason, just I just didn't get around to doing it. And I finally got around to it, and I got to tell you, it was a fantastic book, The Wealthy Franchisee. I mean, I'm not saying I had low expectations, but I've read a lot of stuff on franchising out there, and usually the books I've read aren't that great. So I was pleasantly surprised. So very good job on that.
Wait, well, which books are you saying aren't that great? Name them and name the authors.
Pass. No, here's the thing. People put out books, they come up with fancy titles, they entice you to read it. And then you read it and you go, oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Whatever. Whereas yours was kind of the opposite. I'll just be directly honest. When I first saw The Wealthy Franchisee, I thought, oh, here's another book just on how to get rich quick kind of a thing. And then I read the book and I'm like, no, you're talking about wealth from the perspective of mind, body, spirit, and bank account all together. And I love that approach.
I think it's important. I mean, you know, I went with a traditional publisher. It was published by Entrepreneur Media, who does Entrepreneur Magazine. And so certainly there is, I'll use the word encouragement to have an enticing title with a hook. And, you know, it's interesting. A few months ago, I gave a live keynote at a franchise convention, and I was standing right by the front row as they're getting ready to introduce me. It had my first slide, my introductory slide, with the name of the presentation, which is the same as the book. And an audience member says to me, "I'm really excited because that's exactly what I want. I want to get wealthy." So what went through my mind is, okay, the title is serving its purpose to hook people in. But what I hope to do in the book and, of course, in my presentations is to not only give ways for people to improve their lives or businesses financially, but also with this broader definition of wealth, which is also to have control of your time and quality of life. You know, those two things plus making money together, I think, are what we all should be striving for. So I try to make that clear in the beginning of the book. So yes, there is that sort of that tempting offer there to show you how to make money, but I really aspire to help people achieve even more.
Well, I mean, it worked. Obviously, I mean, the book's doing fantastic. I mean, everywhere I turn, people are recommending it. So good on you for that, because I mean, it's a hard thing to, number one, sit down and do a book. Number two, to get traction on it in this day and age. So that's fantastic. But as I always, you know, like to say, and, you know, a very well-known saying, the cream rises to the top. And, you know, the thing I love about what you're doing, Scott, is first of all, your book comes through as a very transparent and authentic account of your experience. Number one, I mean, your experience as a franchisee with Edible Arrangements and operating multiple units and doing it for a period of time and having some great success with that, along with, you know, the leadership principles and how to hire people and, you know, all the tactical things. But I think it also hits on what franchising really should be about. So, I mean, that's why I'm really looking forward to discussing with you today. I mean, I've been doing franchise legal work for almost 15 years now. And even before that, even before going to law school, I worked for a couple of franchise systems randomly, just, you know, killing time as I was applying to law school, and helped a couple owner operators grow their locations. And so on the business side of things, I got to see that early on. And get a sense for, gosh, I mean, you know, there's a lot of franchisees that come into a system and they just think everything's just going to be rolled right out for them and it's just an automatic success. Is that what you thought when you went into becoming a franchisee at first?
A bit. I knew that a lot of it would come down to, you know, what I brought to it, but I was also a little bit cocky thinking, well, you know, I'm special. I know more. I can bring in things the franchisor doesn't know. And I'm certainly not alone in that. A lot of people try to outsmart the system, that kind of thing. But I was working as a leadership speaker and doing personal professional growth things before it. So I figured, okay, I'll just, you know, use my power of the force, my Jedi mind tricks with employees, that kind of thing. And I'm automatically going to be a top performing franchisee. So it was a huge, huge wake up call. But yeah, I mean, I don't think I fully appreciated how difficult it would be. I knew there'd be some challenges, but I don't think I took them quite as seriously as I should. And I'm certainly not alone in making that mistake.
Well, so did you have previous business experience before franchising that you were speaking? I mean, in terms of the leadership speaking and so forth, what were you speaking on then?
For years prior, and to this day, I had been doing professional speaking. It didn't start off as business speaking. I was a graduate film student at New York University, and I was diagnosed with cancer. And I had to drop out of school and have this whole dramatic experience. And a friend of mine who was putting on a leadership conference said, "Hey, why don't you come to our conference and talk about your experience battling cancer and how it applies to leadership?" I thought that would be a one-off speech and just sort of a nice way of driving some meaning from this challenging experience that I was just finishing up. Well, that presentation led to more invitations to speak. And before I knew it, I was a professional motivational speaker. And my focus was talking about overcoming adversity and resilience. And then over the years, it started expanding to peak performance and then leadership. And it got, you know, broader and broader and farther away from cancer and more about really helping people, you know, achieve goals, lead others, that kind of thing. So I was doing great. I was traveling around the country and getting paid well, but it always bothered me that I hadn't really had a lot of other business experience. And here I am talking to people about leadership when I haven't really engaged in a whole lot of it myself. And so in the back of my mind, I thought, wouldn't it be great if I could have some experience on the side where, you know, I can have, you know, create stories, have my own firsthand experience and a business to use as a laboratory to try these concepts out to see, do I really know what I'm talking about? Or am I just, rehashing cliches that motivational speakers have been kicking around for years? So I had that thought, and that's when I stumbled on an airline magazine ad for edible arrangements, which caught my attention. Before I knew it, I was traveling to Connecticut for a discovery day and decided to go for it. But from the very beginning, the goal was obviously to make money, but to use it as a laboratory to try out different concepts to really see what works. And I figured if I can figure that out, I can use it for my own business. But more importantly, the opportunity for me was to take those concepts and share them with other people to make them more effective running their businesses. So by approaching the business with curiosity as much as ambition, it really helped me learn a lot faster. Not that we didn't have our challenges and make mistakes, and I realized a lot of the things I've been saying on stage absolutely did not translate to the real world. So I think being a professional speaker helped my business, but more importantly, that business experience really helped me become a better speaker and hopefully improve the information that I share with my clients.
Well, first of all, congratulations on obviously beating the cancer, right? I mean, are you cancer free?
Yeah. So that was in the early 90s, and about a year in treatment with chemotherapy and radiation and all that. But the knock on wood, it was successful, and I'm 20 something years now, cancer free. Extremely, extremely grateful.
Well, you know what else your story proves, and that is people actually read those airline magazines. People actually read those things, huh?
I didn't say I read it. I just said I saw it. I was flipping through and I saw a picture of a fruit basket. And I thought, wow, that's kind of interesting. It looks like flowers. I didn't actually read it. Who reads airline magazine?
Scott, I got to be honest with you. Even back, obviously, before phones and stuff, when we would fly around, I would never grab those things. And you know why? I'm kind of a germaphobe. And I would just be like, oh, how many people have touched this magazine? And I just I would never pull them out of the pocket, never pull them out of the slot.
And that was pre-pandemic.
That was pre-pandemic. That's the thing. This pandemic, I was telling my wife this. I said, gosh, it's just taken my germaphobe level to another. It's like, yeah, I know people aren't really wearing masks anymore, but I kind of like it. Yeah, I like that you're wearing a mask.
Who would have known that when we were kids, we were all terrified of giving each other cooties, that it really was preparing us for the real world years later.
Exactly. Well, that's awesome. So you literally decided on the Edible Arrangements franchise because you saw a picture of it in an airline magazine. Now, when you looked at it and you saw, oh, this looks cool. This kind of looks like flowers and it's fruit and everything. What did you do next? Like, did you just go, oh, I'm just going to call them and inquire about it?
I went to their website and got some more information. Talked it through with my father, who had many businesses throughout his life, including franchises, and wanted to get his perspective. The hardest part was convincing my wife, and I did discuss that a bit in the book. But I come from a father who's had a million businesses. Some were great and some were losers, and money came and went, and there was no stability, but it was the excitement of the ride of business ownership. For me, that was normal. My wife's father was a college professor who had two jobs his entire life. So when I said, hey, here's a business I know nothing about, let's take a bunch of money from our home equity and let's invest in it. She was like, what? So, convincing her was much harder than convincing a bank to loan me money.
Well, and you put it in the book, but I think it's a really interesting story. And I think it's very, very important because I know when I'm working with franchisees or prospective franchisees or just in general, I mean, it's so important that the spouse is going to be involved, even if they're not involved directly in the business, because they're involved emotionally in the ups and downs, in the stress. They're part of that equation no matter what. How did you convince your wife that this was going to be a good move?
Basically just nagging over and over again, saying, come on. We have different thresholds for stress and for pain and different tolerance for risk. And so it's a give and take. I'm happy to talk to franchisees about how to improve their businesses. I'm not sure I'm qualified for marital advice. I might be more of a cautionary tale.
She was a good supportive spouse then. That's what you're saying. She believed in you.
More than supportive. I can be impulsive. I mean, people ask me, how many franchise brands did you look at before you chose Edible? I didn't look at any. And I saw it. I thought it's cool. I can make this work, and was very irresponsible. And so what my wife did and what she continues to do is when I throw some crazy idea, she asks me the big, powerful questions that I really should be able to answer before pulling the trigger. So she slowed me down. She forced me to really think about, you know, what it would take to break even, to crunch the numbers. And so I think together we're really a great pair. And so she's been instrumental. She was not involved in the operations of the business. That was part of the agreement. She's like, you can do it, but you're doing it alone. So the only thing she ever offered over those years was a little bit of unsolicited advice, which was fine. But she was incredibly supportive and generally is. But she is cynical and asks me questions when that's really what's needed. And you know, it's an important point, this notion of the spouse for a franchise business. It really is. You know, you're not just buying a business, you're buying a lifestyle. And whether your spouse is involved or not in the business, it certainly is impacting their life, and they're going to be part of the decision-making. And so, you know, development people would be wise to take that into consideration and really try to be of comfort and answer questions for both people, whether both people operate or not.
Do you look back, though, and think, because I kind of think this after reading your book and just reading up on you, not just for this interview, but just being interested after I read the book because I liked it so much, and thinking to myself, you just may be one of those people that it could have been an edible arrangements, it could have been a Quiznos, it could have been anything, and you would have found a way to make it successful, right? I mean, there's people who are like that, and it may be an uncomfortable question for you, but I think it's I'm asking it in the context of, you know, I spend a lot of time, I'm sure you do, when you're speaking about different personas, you know, franchisee personas and who's good for franchising, who's bad for franchising. I just get the sense though with you that it could have been a lot of different things and you would have been equally as successful. Am I wrong?
Well, here's the thing. I was a really good franchisee. I was not a great franchisee. I never ranked number. I mean, we won some awards and everything, you know, which was great. And at one point they asked me to, you know, even speak at the Edible Arrangements Convention about, you know, building high performing teams. And so, you know, I participated in some councils, but, you know, I was never like number one. I'd never won franchisee of the year. And I don't think those things were warranted. There were some really, continue to be some really great franchisees there. And so when I use the phrase, the wealthy franchisee, which is the title of my book and the brand under which I do business, I'm not necessarily referring to myself. I'm someone who's observed them, who's studied them, who's interviewed them and talk about them. For me, I was very successful. I felt good because the goal wasn't just to be a franchisee, it was to be a professional speaker. And I also had this business going, you know, on the side, and I was able to balance that. So in that way, it's great. But I think the bigger point is where I will agree with you is when you look at who wealthy franchisees are, who I profile in my book, my presentations, I totally agree with you, Josh. I think that you could take someone who's just killing it at some, you know, senior in-home care franchise, and you put them in a quick service restaurant. I think applying the same concepts, they're going to get the same results. I do not subscribe to the notion that you have to be passionate about the business. I was never passionate about fruit or fruit baskets. I think you have to be passionate about something about the business. And for me, it was about managing employees and delighting customers. Those things really excited me.
Well, because you were making somebody's day.
Yeah, but there's a lot of ways to make someone's day. For me, what makes real franchisees great, it's not that they have some amazing location. It's not that they necessarily love the product, service, or solution they sell, but it's something bigger and broader and something that can be applied elsewhere. So I agree that if you take a wealthy franchisee, a top franchisee from one concept, put them in a very different industry, and they have a moderate level of interest, they're a good bet that they're going to thrive in that other brand as well. That's my experience. And so we enjoyed some success, but I don't think it was specific to fruit baskets. It was more the larger things rooted in the human part of the business, which all of my work is really about that, the human elements that impact our performance. Those things are universal. So you apply them in any business and you're going to get great results.
Well, and it took you some time to kind of get to this place. I mean, when you call Edible Arrangements, you go through the process. Let me ask you this. Did you have somebody review your franchise disclosure document, or did you just get it and just sign it?
You mean a lawyer?
Yeah, a lawyer, a consultant, anybody. Did you have anybody take a look, or did you get the FDD and you were so excited you just signed right on?
I signed right on. And I'm telling you, I'm a cautionary tale. I would never advise anyone to do what I did. I was fortunate that it was a great brand, and the plenty of things were revealed in the franchise disclosure document, and you know, the franchise agreement, it's changed between when I first signed it and then 10 years later when I signed it again. I think I should have had a lawyer look at it. So I highly recommend that. But no, I was very impulsive, and as a lot of people are, and gave in to my emotions. It worked out for me, but I would never advise anyone to follow that path.
Well, you talk about this in the book. Again, you know, The Wealthy Franchisee, highly, highly recommend it. But spend a minute or two and talk about when you first got into the business. I mean, it wasn't all, you know, roses and sunshine or anything like that. I mean, you had to learn the hard way. I mean, you had to learn how to do these things. You had to learn how to really manage people, how to deal with inconsistencies of employees and customer service and all those sorts of things, right? I mean, you had to really kind of learn this out of the gate.
Yeah, and even more, I had to unlearn a bunch of things I thought were true or I thought applied.
Like what? What did you think?
Well, look, my original background is from this world of motivational speaking and personal growth, which I think is great. And I still do a lot of work in that area. But there's a lot of cliches bouncing around, a lot of speakers who are quoting each other. There's one story that's just still going around that was debunked by Fast Company magazine about, usually they say it's at Yale, you know, the Yale University Business School. And they said, you know, those people who write down their goals are 10 times more likely to achieve them. And they followed MBA students. That study never took place. So when I researched it out, like Zig Ziglar had quoted it. And then I researched out, well, he then attributed it to someone else. It's all these speakers who are quoting each other, but not actually quoting any data. So you hear these things about, you know, turn your frown upside down, and it's all about attitude. They say there's no I in team. You know, I share that with my employees. For them, that's a comment on spelling. There's nothing meaningful about that. These are people who, you know, want to make money, who want to support their families, or who want to get money for something. And you got to go beyond the cliches, and you have to get into the weeds. And so it was a real wake-up call there. And so these days in my presentations, I really don't preach positivity. I don't think that, you know, positive attitude or faith are going to cut costs, are going to drive traffic to your business. I still want to preach negativity, but what I preach is clarity, is understanding all the thoughts and emotions that are swimming around your brain and distracting you, making you subjective, clearing those things out, and then seeing things as they are. So we're doing an audio recording now, not a video recording. I have a glass of water on my desk. The optimist would say it's half full. The pessimist would say it's half empty. The wealthy franchisee says the glass is 4 ounces of water. It's objective. It's data, right? Your attitude shouldn't come into it. You should clear your head. That's when we make the best decisions.
But let me ask you a question. And how do you do that? So you focus on the human element. And when you talk about humans and you talk about people, you're talking about emotions as well. So how do you balance those two?
Well, it's interesting because I don't think you want to operate without emotion, because emotion is the basis for empathy and for providing great service. You know, that when you manage your employees, you have to understand their emotional beings. And for you to understand that and help them through it, you yourself have to go through it. And with customer experiences, I spent a lot of time in the book talking about great customer experiences aren't just keeping your promise. It's about elevating their emotions, knowing emotionally, whether they realize it or not, emotionally, what is it the customer wants and what can you do to heighten that emotion? Because people remember what they feel much more so than what they got. So there is a place for emotions. But it's when you're running your business and you're feeling the stress or you're feeling the enthusiasm, and these thoughts and emotions start to distract you or lead you down a destructive path. We need to be able to pause and reflect. Now, top franchisees are emotional and they do react and they do catastrophize. But what makes them special is they pause. They notice it. They spend as much time looking in the mirror as they do looking at their P&Ls. To make sure that they themselves are in good shape. So they'll go for a walk, they'll meditate, or they'll wait until they've reached what I call their point of clarity. Once you're there, then you can make much better decisions. But it takes some discipline, and most people don't, because they fall into the biggest problem in business, which is busyness. And it stops us from leading, it stops us from serving, and it stops us from getting ourselves to our point of clarity. And so we end up making bad decisions.
Yeah, you know, you were talking a few minutes ago about misinformation or bad data. One of the things I realized, I remember early on, this was years and years ago when, you know, I first got into franchising, is, you know, you always hear, oh, you buy a franchise, you have way better chance of success. than just starting your own business. And you sort of say to yourself, well, that kind of makes sense, right? I mean, you've got somebody, you got a proven model, you've got a proven business that you're buying, you're working with, you know, a franchisor that's going to be providing you with operations and marketing. So it all sounds kind of great. But then when you actually break down the data, it's actually not true until you've been in business for 5 years or more. You know, once you've been in business for 5 years or more, then your percentages go up. But when you're just getting started with a franchise or you're just getting started with a regular startup, the percentages aren't all that different. You might have a slightly better chance at franchising. But it's just sort of interesting how data and information just kind of gets out there and it becomes the truth, even though it's really not, some of it's just really not true at all. But it makes people feel better about their situations and about the decisions that they're making.
It's such a good point. You know, I hear this a lot, you know, in my field of public speaking, where people say, well, you know, X number of percent is what you say, but the other big percent is your body language and all that stuff. And again, same thing. How's that being measured? And I've tried to research that out and look for good information. And there really isn't a lot of good information about communications like that, where it's definitive. And so we want to make good decisions based on information, but the information itself sometimes is hard to access. To this day, I still don't know what the percentage is of businesses that close in the first year, in the first 18 months. You know, there's different ways of looking at that. I think the important thing to understand is it's a risk. There's no guarantees. So you do the best you can. And the reason why I think, you know, it may not be true that a franchise business within the first 5 years, you know, has better odds is because there's a lot that the franchisor can't control. They might have a perfect system and, you know, great pricing and great branding, but what the franchisor can't control is what each franchisee brings to their own business, their level of resilience and their level of energy, their ability to stick to the system. The franchisor can create it, but they can't always, you know, get the franchisee to stick to it. There's a lot of things that are outside of the franchisor's control. So the perfect tool in the wrong hands is not necessarily going to get great results. And so I just think that franchisees and aspiring franchisees really need to take up the time to reflect on what they're going to bring to the business.
So after you bought the first location for Edamo Ranch, was this on a resale or was this a brand new location that you developed?
First one was brand new.
Okay. And how long did you operate that before you bought your second location?
I think it was about 6 years.
6 years. And then I believe you then bought a second struggling location that was already in operation.
Yeah. So in California, I believe there are about, I think, 105 locations. And, you know, every week we'd get our rankings. And so my first store in any given week was almost always in the top five. Very often we were ranked number one. The store that when I bought it, it was ranked 104th out of 105. So I think the story would be better if it really was the last one. But I got to give the guy credit. He worked his way up to 104th out of 105th. So it really was a bit of a rescue operation, that one.
What was the problem, by your estimation?
I think it was an operator who didn't care that much and who definitely did not care at all about customer experience. It was just there in the Yelp reviews. And we would occasionally have customers call us and say, I had a really bad experience with a location, so we're giving you guys a shot. I always cringed when I heard that because I figured for everyone who decided to call us, there's probably 20 who wrote off the brand altogether. So it wasn't being managed well. It was being neglected. Customers weren't being taken care of. And employees weren't being taken care of. And those are things that I focus on most, sort of the mindset of myself, mindset of the franchisee, and then the culture that you create, all the people who are involved, which are certainly your employees and it's your customers. These are the things that matter most. And so those are the things that we emphasized when we took over that second location.
That was your sweet spot too. So it made a lot of sense because you're looking at this franchisee that's 104th out of 105, let's say. And you're saying to yourself, well, gee, if he or she could just do better with building a better culture and following through on a better customer experience and doing some of those things, which are the things that are your strengths, then you could turn this thing around, which obviously you ended up doing.
Yeah. But the stakes were very high for me and not for the reasons you think. Remember, the reason I got in the business in the first place, I wanted a second stream of revenue for myself, but I really wanted to understand the concepts, to be able to name them of what it takes to run a successful business so I could teach those things to other people. So we did a bunch of stuff in the first location, built it up, won awards, made money, any of these things that were really great. But now the question is, could I take those same concepts and use them to turn another business around? If what I had concluded was true, then the answer should be yes. We should be able to see it. But if it turns out we just got lucky and just got a good location and that's why we're doing well, I'd find that out too. And that was kind of a scary thing. So to be able to take a struggling business, try out our concepts, and see that we got results, that's when I felt, okay, now I'm ready for the big time. Now it's time to really focus on, you know, eventually writing this book for franchisees and, you know, tell some speakers, bureaus about it. So that was a big thing for me. We always made more money from the first location, but I think I was more proud of what we accomplished with the second location, because that's how we were able to validate all these conclusions we were drawing about what really makes a difference in franchise businesses.
What was harder, starting from scratch with the first or doing a turnaround with the second?
The first one.
Really?
First one, for me, it was uncharted territory. Everything was new. You know, the franchisor certainly gave us advice, but we had to, you know, trust them, you know. And I remember one time I had got Tarek Fareed, the founder and CEO of the company, on the phone. I was considering the location where we ultimately signed the lease, and it was very expensive, you know. But he's like, hey, but, you know, it's going to pay for itself because you're going to get more traffic. But what else is he going to tell me?
It's easy for him to say, right? Yeah. He doesn't have to pay the bill.
Right. And so, again, not that he gave me bad advice. I mean, it did work out. But after, you know, 6 years of experience, I now knew so much more about what really was important, what wasn't. I had more realistic understanding and expectations of what it's really going to take to reopen. You know, there's less mystery. There certainly were outstanding questions, but less mystery compared to the first time. Plus, I already had a team of employees who I could kind of move over there. So for me, it was a lot scarier, a lot more difficult the first time around compared to the takeover.
It's interesting because I was thinking about that question a little bit and thinking to myself, you know, not having done it, but just thinking through it, I might say it would be harder to do a turnaround because the cake's already half-baked. You know, as opposed to a blank canvas that you're working with. Because that's hard, right? I mean, it's hard to go in when, number one, people have already been to that location, and the ones that haven't had a good experience, it's hard to get them back. And you've got the online reviews, you've got all that other stuff that you kind of feel like you're swimming upstream a little bit.
Undoubtedly. But I saw all those things as opportunities. So as soon as we signed the contract, I went out and printed a under new management sign and looked at the Yelp reviews and then made it a point to then start posting, hey, we're now under new management, to really, you know, engage with the online reviews. I knew what the opportunities were. I knew where they were falling short. And so we were able to make those things a priority. Now, what I didn't expect was to have to invest as much in rebuilding it. The previous owner, I didn't buy it from the previous owner. It got shut down by our corporate office. And I think by the health department, it got shut down. Wow. So the corporate office said, hey, we're going to give you an opportunity to take this thing over. All you have to do is pay a franchise fee and then you can walk in. I'm like, fantastic. And then after we signed that agreement, in the middle of the night, the old franchisee went in and gutted the place. Literally took the kitchen sink, everything.
Are you serious?
Edible arrangement sign outside the building. They took that. That in itself was 10 grand for me to replace. So I had to reconstruct it and buy all the stuff I didn't think. So at least we ended up with something more, you know, that was sparkling and clean, but it costs significantly more money. But again, we were able to breathe new life into it, and that made a difference. But yeah, it took some time for us to win customers back. So those challenges were there, but we came in much more equipped and much better idea of what needed to happen. So for me, it was not quite as difficult as that first store.
You know, you had mentioned a little bit earlier on in the interview about passion and how, you know, you're not one of those people that just goes, hey, go follow your passion and it'll all work out. And I think it's a really interesting and good point because, you know, I think when you are newer in business, and oftentimes it can be younger people too, who are just kind of getting into the fray, but it doesn't always have to be that way. But when you're newer in business or in anything you want to do, right, you sort of feel like, you know, I got to love what I do. I got to find that passion. And yeah, I used to think that a little bit years and years ago. But what I've grown to realize over time is that you oftentimes find your passion by just doing the work. In other words, you go and do something and you give it all your effort, and within that, you find your passion along the way. I'd love for you to speak on that a little bit.
You've articulated that so well. There are things that you can find within the business that can get you excited. That doesn't mean that you have to love frozen yogurt or love cheeseburgers or love killing mosquitoes. And the truth is, when you own a business, that service you provide has very little to do with what you're actually doing. If you're really growing your business and focusing on what matters, it's all about people. And everyone says they're in the people business, but no one really reflects on what that means. And to me, it means really knowing how to partner well with your franchisor, getting to the community, elevating your employees to make them leaders, and then elevating the emotional state of your customers. Those things have very little to do with the thing that you're selling. And there are some people who really love customer service. There are some people who really love, cooking things. As long as there's something about the business that is exciting and wonderful for you, the rest of the things you can put up with. So I do think there needs to be some level of deep interest. I think passion's a strong word, but something that you can get excited about. I think that is important. But to just say you have to love the thing that you're selling, the problem is there's so much more to it than what you're selling. And so I don't subscribe to that. And I realize that it seems a little bit counterintuitive for someone who used to describe himself as a motivational speaker to say, I don't preach positive attitude. And I don't think you have to be passionate about what you do. But I want, I want to be authentic and I want to help people. And I think that we need to go beyond those cliches. And having now done all these interviews for my presentations and for my book to understand these top franchisees, they're not all passionate about it. And they don't all have fantastic locations and they're not always positive, but they're kind of balanced and they're clear and they have stress, but they manage it well.
But they have a vision. I think they have a vision, right? I mean, I think every successful business person or anybody who's successful in life, whether it's business or in a creative, in the creative arts or anything like that, they have a vision for what their definition of success is. And it changes over time. So it's not like, you go in and oftentimes, oh, this is my grand vision and it never changes. But the point is, they may not be passionate about everything that they're doing, but if they have a clear vision in terms of where they want to go with it, that can be oftentimes more satisfying.
Yeah. And a lot of these people who I met are not necessarily driven by money exclusively. Some of them are really passionate about their employees. I interviewed one person who said the main reason why she does it, she worked, fast food when she was young and it really created opportunities for her. And for her, obviously she wants to make money, but she really wants to make a difference for people. And she uses her business to do that. For me, I wanted to make money, but my big thing is I really wanted to learn. I love the idea of personal growth and leadership. So I love the idea of being able to have a business, sort of a laboratory where I could try stuff out and see what works I still love that and I'm so grateful for that opportunity. So I think you have to find something, but it doesn't have to be that surface product, service, or solution. That in and of itself doesn't have to be the thing that drives you.
So when you're out there and you're speaking and you're doing it for large brands, McDonald's and Great Clips and Anytime Fitness. I believe the founder of Anytime Fitness is the foreword in your book, correct?
Yeah, Chuck Runyon. He was really really great to do that.
Yeah, Wyndham Hotel Group and Remax and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you're out there speaking to franchisees who are already part of a system, right? I mean, that's primarily what you're not talking to groups who are contemplating becoming franchisees. You're talking to people primarily who are already within a system. Is that accurate?
Yeah. Now, probably 30% of my audiences aren't even franchises, but that really is kind of my main primary lane. And in that world, I'm either talking to franchisors, but usually current franchisees. So not necessarily aspiring franchisees, but people who are already doing it.
What's the other 30%? What's that?
Everything else.
Really?
Yeah. I had a presentation not that long ago for a company, for the sales force for a company that sells spine surgery devices. Because when you think of spine surgery, there's no other expert you could think of other than the edible arrangements guy. But I didn't talk to them about spine surgery devices. I didn't talk about fruit baskets, but I talked to the sales professionals about the mindset behind sales and the need to be able to get to your point of clarity. The ability to really connect with your prospects and build relationships, about handling rejection and resilience. There are universal concepts that apply to a lot of different things. I guess my love for the franchise world, coming from a background of teaching personal growth, is it's just scientifically more interesting because you have all these people doing the same thing, but getting different results. So there's more controls and variables that you can study. The personal growth side of it, understanding those differences, that's what I find really interesting. But the conclusions that I've been able to draw are universal. So I speak to all kinds of different audiences that are, you know, in business or doing different things. But, you know, franchising is my background. It's where I have more credibility. And so for now, that's it's my niche.
Now, when you're speaking to these franchisees, okay, what's the most common question people are asking you at the end when they're coming up? Whether it's, you know, asking through the audience or just coming up one-on-one, are there some things where you just hear questions over and over and over again as you speak to these franchisees?
What's interesting is when people come up, and that is a, you know, a big part of what I do and I really enjoy it, most of the time they actually want to share stories. They want to talk about their experience, like something in the concepts that I discussed applied to them, and they want to share it with me, which is very interesting. And I'm always happy to have those conversations. But I would say that when people come up to me and, you know, they reach out and they have questions, whether it's after a presentation or if they, you know, find me, you know, contact me, you know, on the phone or, you know, internet or whatever, a lot of it has to do with employees, especially these days. As you probably know, right now, staffing is really challenging for people. They just can't find employees. But even when that's not the issue, employers don't know how to motivate their employees. They don't know how to lead them. Especially in the franchise space, where you don't necessarily have to have a background in management or leadership to be sold a franchise. And franchisors are reluctant to teach much about management and leadership. Number one, that may not be part of their expertise. And number two, they don't want to be called joint employers. So they stay away from, you know, these kinds of issues altogether. So it sort of leaves a hole there. They'll teach you how to make the tacos, but they're not going to necessarily teach you how to motivate your cooks and chefs and people who are doing the making of the tacos. So I get asked about that a lot. A lot of people want to come up and just kind of share sort of their mental struggle. They've been at it for years and they've reached a certain level, but they feel stuck and they don't know how to unstick themselves. So I get that a lot. But usually it's related to managing people. I probably get that more than anything.
What would you say? I mean, it's really hard with managing people. And like you said, it's a real big issue right now in terms of just not being able to find the right people or any people for a position. What do you tell people? What do you believe in terms of outside of, you know, paying somebody a fair livable wage? What's the most important thing that people desire in their employment?
Well, that is a great question. And the answer is not always something financial. Next week, I'm doing a 3-day leadership retreat for a team of people who work for a large photography company. So all the employees, they're all in their 20s and 30s, and I've already surveyed them. And I gave them a list of 12 things that you can get from your job. Things like interesting work, personal growth, job security, of course, you know, high wages, you know, I think like 12 different things. And I asked them to rank from 1 to 12. Salary came in at number 4. And I've done this survey countless times in all kinds of different industries, and salary very rarely is at the top. It's towards the top, maybe somewhere between 3 and 5, but usually it's much more about wanting to do something meaningful or personal growth. For a long time, I found that it was always feeling appreciated for the work that I do. Lately, that hasn't been coming up as high as it was maybe 10 years ago, but generally it still ranks pretty high. And I once did the same survey for my own employees at Edible Arrangements, and it's the same thing. And it's so important because you're trying to build a great culture, and a great culture is a place that satisfies the values of the members of that culture. So two things need to happen: that you have to have a workplace that, you know, celebrates a certain set of values, and then you have to have people whose values are aligned with the workplace values. So part of it is you need to stop and reflect on, you know, what are the values that we can celebrate here, and what can't we? And then hire people who are aligned with that. At Edible Arrangements, you know, for my locations, not the company in general, but my locations, if you valued family, that was big for me, and I wanted to treat our employees like a family. We had picnics with other kids, and I would always let employees leave to go to their kids' appointments and plays because we value that. If you value personal growth, heck, I was a motivational speaker. I would do, you know, clinics after hours to teach my employee things they loved it. If you valued creativity, we're a terrible place to work. Now, remember, I went to film school. I value creativity, but Edible Arrangements can't. We tell you where to put every single grape or piece of cantaloupe. There's no choices. So people who need artistic expression in their work, they didn't enjoy being restricted. If you value education, again, something I value, but highly educated people, college students, college graduates, never lasted long at Edible Arrangements, not at my locations, because the work was too monotonous. So if someone said in an interview they really value education or they really value the arts, that was a strike against them, not as a person, but as a good fit for my location, because we couldn't honor those values. So the idea is to assess, you know, understand what are the values that you can honor so you know what type of employees you're looking for. And then when you evaluate your employees, try to get a sense of what is it that they care about. And most people care about having a sense of belonging. So if you're very deliberate about creating a culture, people are more likely to stay. But I will tell you that most people don't know what it means to create a culture. They think it means saying thank you, being nice, buying people pizza, and giving them gift cards. That's not culture. That's being nice to people. So they appreciate, but that's not going to create loyalty.
How do you create that culture then? I mean, in this kind of a business or in a retail type setting, how do you create that culture? I mean, is it just you as the owner leading by example, showing up every day? I mean, what is it that creates a culture?
Great question. I'm actually speaking on this in the next couple of days to a couple of different franchises about this very issue. There are three things that make up a culture, some of which we have more control than others. The first is language, having everybody speak the same way. So it might be a country's literal language that they speak. So the fact that you and I speak English, that kind of connects us compared to if we saw someone who was speaking Greek and you and I don't speak Greek, there's going to be some distance there. But language could also mean having a certain vocabulary. At Edible Arrangements, we used to kale our baskets. We'd use that as a verb. McDonald's, there was controversy. For years, they referred to the entire system as the McFamily. And a new CEO said, no, we're really not a family. It's something different. We're going to become a McTeam. That created controversy because the language, the terminology mattered to people. So having a common language is one thing. That's not that deep though. And if you own a franchise business, you know, you might come up with some terminology, but there's not much to do there. The second thing is a set of beliefs, common beliefs. If we believe the same things are true, we believe the same things are important. So if you think of a religion, you know, people of the same religion have the same beliefs about what actually has happened, you know, the creation of the religion. And then they have the same set of beliefs about what is important, the same set of values. So a lot of companies, a lot of businesses have a mission statement. They have values. But just like a religion, if you just declare these things, but you don't pay attention to them, then you're not going to get very far. So the third thing, and this is where that's the biggest opportunity and really to answer your question, are rituals. Regular practices that reinforce the philosophy, mission, and beliefs. So again, if you think of a religion, there is regular prayer, there's holidays, there's meals that are all there to reinforce it. Think of business. Ritz-Carlton, they have their daily stand-up meetings where for 20 minutes, every employee, every shift, they stand up and their supervisor takes them through their values for the company. They recite their company credo. And they'll share a story of someone who satisfied a customer. And every single day, every employee goes through this. Pride Staff is a franchise here in California, and their best franchisees have regular meetings where they recite their values. So the idea is to come up with rituals that really reinforce what's important as a reminder. Because if we don't, then we get busy, and then we're, you know, we're active, but we're not proactive. So in order to create a great culture, you need to create rituals that reinforce and remind people of the things that are important. And that small investment of time saves you time because it builds loyalty because people feel connected to the culture. So it's language, it's a common set of beliefs, and a common set of rituals. It's not just being nice to people.
Well, and really that's all about community too, right? I mean, you're building this sort of community infrastructure within your business, right, where people feel like they're a part of something as opposed to just showing up to something. Would you agree with that?
Oh, completely. We had one employee, I remember her saying to us one time, she says, when I come to work, I feel like this is my sanctuary. Because the rest of her life, she didn't really feel a connection to friends or family, not at the same level. And so I think when people feel professional love and respect for each other, for the team, they're more likely to show up to work and they're more likely to produce at work because they are invested. I hear employers all the time say, you know, their employees, hey, I want you to act like it's your business. Why should they? It's not their business unless you somehow make it theirs, not just by, you know, paying them a percentage of sales, but by making them feel like it's a culture, that they are a part of something. We are a social species. We want a sense of belonging. There's that famous study that Harvard's been doing where they've been following graduates, a group of men for like the last 75 years. And they've been tracking everything about these people and some people who didn't graduate Harvard, some people from, you know, really poor people from Boston, the same age, tracking these guys for decades. And when they looked at the people who've lived the longest and reported being the happiest, it wasn't those with the highest income or the lowest cholesterol. It was those with the most meaningful relationships and who really felt connected to others. So if we can create that in our businesses, really create a sense of team, a sense of family, as you just said, we're going to get better results from people because we're really meeting this internal need that human beings have. That can't happen when you're just paying them to show up and just directing their work and then sending them home. It really has to be something that needs attention.
And it can't be faked either. I mean, it has to be authentic. That's the real tricky part is, you know, there's not a formula that you follow and you go, because that's where the sort of the rituals and everything else turns into, hey, I buy pizza every Tuesday, right? Well, that's not what you're talking about. Could the community and the feeling of belonging and the feeling that you're part of something, everywhere I've seen it, it's because the leader, the owner, the leader of the team believes it in his or her core. I mean, it's what they live. It's how they operate. It's not something that's fake. It's not something that's, you know, just arbitrarily put in, you know, disguised so that they can really just try to make more profit. It's literally something that is a credo that they understand and know and believe in. And then that becomes that community and those rituals that then, you know, becomes the engine that helps everything grow. I've never seen it work where it's not authentic, ever.
It's absolutely true, you know. But tell that to a franchisor development person who wants to sell franchises. You know, they want to sell as many as possible. And to say, well, you know, we know you're financially qualified, but it doesn't seem like you're going to have a deep love for your employees, so we're not going to sell to you. It's hard for a franchisor to hold prospective franchisees to that. But I think there's a missed opportunity for a lot of franchisees. I meet franchisees who really love their own children and love their own families, but don't care about their employees. Well, there's not that much of a difference. I mean, you think because, you know, someone is, you know, born of you or, you know, your daughter, you know, they live in your home, their family, that's great. But you can enjoy a lot of the same emotions with your employees. And I'm not saying your employees are the same as your kids, but if you can approach them from a nurturing standpoint, there's an opportunity for you to derive some of the same fulfillment and meaning that we get from being parents. We can get that from being employers. And as if you're not trying with your employees, we'll use a franchisee, you're missing out on a beautiful part of what being a business owner can be, which is elevating other people. The funny thing is, let's say you don't care about them at all, you just want to make more money. Being loving towards them and nurturing them is still the best way to make money because it's going to create the culture. It's going to create the loyalty, which will lead to better service and ultimately better sales. But you really have to, again, think just beyond the profit and loss statement. And that's it's really the main point of my book is that we really need to use our business to improve the lives of everyone it touches. And when you just put value in every direction, there's a boomerang effect and it comes back to you.
Well, Scott, I've really, really enjoyed this last hour we've spent together. For anybody who wants to learn more about Scott and everything that he's doing, go to scottgreenberg.com, www.scottgreenberg.com. You can also go to www.thewealthyfranchisee.com. The full title of the book is The Wealthy Franchisee, Game-Changing Steps to Becoming a Thriving Franchise Superstar. Wow, that sounds fantastic.
Good. Remember, yeah, that hook is there, right? So,
but here's the thing I will say. It is true. It's a really, really, really good book. And I don't just say that because I'm not going to, if I say that on here and somebody goes and it sucks, trust me, I'll hear about it. But I think it's really good. And I really, really like what you're doing. I mean, I think people in franchising need to hear more about this. I think people get caught up in franchising on the wrong things. And they get, sometimes they get duped into, oh, my franchisor is not doing this, so I just can't be successful. Other times they just focus on the wrong things. And there's just so many other ways to make it work. And that's not trying to be overly optimistic and not realistic, but the proof is in the pudding in what you've done and what a lot of people have done out there. So I really think your message is really, really good and valued in the franchise space. So I know you speak in other areas, it sounds like, but I hope you continue in the franchise space because you have a lot to offer there.
Yes. Well, after what I said earlier, I'm not going to say it's my passion, but I really, really enjoy this world. I now feel like I've, you know, cultivated relationships. It's just, you know, I'm a franchisee at heart. So I think I'll be here for a while. And I appreciate all your kind comments about the book. People keep asking me how the book is doing. And what they mean is, how is it selling? But for me, the real measurement of how the book is doing is, what's it doing for other people's businesses? And so I hope that anybody who gets it, who listens to it, that it really provides them the growth that they want, because ultimately that's the whole purpose of writing it.
Well, and before we go, let me just ask you this. I mean, are you all booked out, or how are you? I didn't even bother. We talked about so many other things. I'm just, obviously through COVID, you were probably doing some Zoom presentations and so forth. Maybe not so much, but are you out there traveling around now, going out and meeting in businesses and doing all those sorts of things?
Well, the way that in the life of a speaker, the way your works is, the way your schedule is now is a reflection of how things were 6 months ago. So 6 months ago, franchises were still reluctant to plan in-person things. That's now changing. So I've got two franchise conventions I'm going to this week and something else the following week. But the last 60 days have been incredible in terms of the outreach. And so I expect to be much busier in the coming days. So I'm really, really excited. And I mean, obviously, I want to be out there and, you know, making a living. But it's also a sign that I think the franchise industry is going to be roaring back. And we've got some really good times ahead.
Yeah, I don't think there's any doubt about that. I'm seeing all those signs as well. So thank you so much, Scott. I'd say good luck, but I don't think you need it.
I'll take it.
Be well. Thank you so much for coming on.
Such a pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much for tuning into another episode of Franchise Euphoria. If you enjoyed it, please head over to Apple Podcasts and leave a rating and review. It really helps to get this show out to more and more people. Also, if you have any questions, have ideas for guests or topics, please email me, josh@indyfranchiselaw.com. That's josh@indyfranchiselaw.com. And finally, please note that this podcast is for entertainment and educational purposes and is not in any way, shape, or form meant to be any kind of legal advice. If you're seeking legal advice, please contact a lawyer. Have a great one. Happy franchising.